Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are wading into what I think might be the most uncomfortable territory in the entire Infinite Investor series.
I think you're right. We're back with part two, based on the work of Jocelyn Dubey.
And it's uncomfortable because it's not about spreadsheets, is it?
No, it is certainly the most confrontational part of his framework. It forces you to look in the mirror in a way that, a discounted cash flow model usually doesn't.
Exactly. If you were with us for part one, you'll remember we covered the architecture of money. We talked all about position sizing.
Right, capital allocation.
We went deep into compounders versus amplifiers, the mathematics of ruin. All of that was about how you manage a finite resource, and that resource was capital.
That was the mechanics. We call it the chassis of the car, if you will, the hard numbers.
But today we are making a hard pivot. We're moving from your money to your mind. We're tackling part two.
The attention cost.
And this is where it gets personal. It really does, because the core thesis here is terrifyingly simple. It's that you might have enough money to buy everything in the market, but you definitely do not have enough brain power to understand it all.
That's the entire crux of it. Dubey argues that while capital is obviously scarce, attention is the real limiting reagent. It is the bottleneck that, almost every single investor ignores until it's far too late.
We just act like it's an infinite well we can draw from.
Completely. We act as if our ability to process information is limitless, but it is actually the most constrained, most precious resource we possess, and it's non-renewable.
And looking through these sources, the white papers, the behavioral studies, Dubey's own notes, it honestly feels less like investment advice and more like a psychological intervention.
It is. It's behavioral hygiene.
The central argument is that our smallest positions, the ones we think are harmless, are actually the ones destroying our returns, not financially, but cognitively.
It's what Dubey calls the bookmark pathology. And it's so insidious because it feels productive. It looks like diligence. It looks like you're doing the work.
But he argues it's actually a form of cognitive suicide.
That's the term he uses, yes. A strong one, but he backs it up.
Okay, before we get to the suicide part, which is a very strong opening, by the way, let's set the stage because I really want to push back on this idea right from the start.
Good, let's do it.
I think this is going to be a hard sell for a lot of people listening, and I have to admit, it's a hard sell for me too.
Okay, why is that? What's the immediate reaction?
Because the typical investor logic, which I have used myself 1,000 times, goes like this. I see an interesting stock. Maybe it's a speculative biotech, could be a turnaround play, whatever.
Something on the fringes.
Exactly. I don't know enough to bet the farm on it, so I buy a starter position, a bookmark, maybe 0.5% of the portfolio, maybe even less, 0.2%.
Just a little taste.
And the logic is if I own it, I'll track it. It forces me to pay attention. It's a learning tool.
Tuition, right. That's what we usually call it. I'm paying tuition to the market.
Exactly. It's a tuition position. If it goes to zero, I lose 0.5%. Who cares? It's scratch on the paint. But if it doubles, hey, I feel smart. I feel like a free option.
Okay.
So, why is that a pathology? To me, that feels like prudent exploration. It feels smart.
And that feeling, that sense of being prudent, is precisely the trap. Dubey just destroys this logic in the first chapter of the source material.
Oh.
The argument is that there is no such thing as a free option in a portfolio. There's no free lunch.
Yeah.
Because every single line item, no matter how tiny the dollar value is, it carries an invisible carrying cost.
This is the attention rent.
Correct. Think about what you just said. If I own it, I'll track it. That is an admission of liability right there. You have just signed an unwritten contract with your own brain.
A contract to do what?
To process data, to worry, to
Yeah.
spend cognitive cycles on a ticker symbol that has, for all intents and purposes, zero meaningful impact on your financial life.
But isn't that just discipline? I mean, shouldn't I be tracking things? If I want to learn about a sector, don't I need some skin in the game to really focus?
That's the story we tell ourselves. But let's look at the biology of it for a second. The human brain, our primate brain, does not scale attention linearly with position size. This is the fundamental error in that logic.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
You don't spend 100 times less mental energy on a 0.1% position than you do on a 10% position. You just don't. In fact, the source material suggests it's often an inverse relationship.
The squeaky wheel effect, the loudest thing gets the grease.
Precisely. Often that 0.5% position is the most volatile. It's the penny stock jumping 20% in a day or dropping 30%. It's the one that triggers your dopamine loops. It triggers the fight or flight response.
And it lights up the screen. It's bright red or bright green.
So you end up checking the 0.5% position 10 times a day while your 20% boring blue chip compounder just sits there, quietly making you rich, but completely ignored.
Okay, I can feel that. I have definitely had days where I'm compulsively refreshing a quote for a stock that if I actually stopped and did the math, couldn't buy me a nice dinner even if it doubled.
We all have.
But I'm checking it like my mortgage depends on it. It's almost embarrassing to admit.
It's human nature. You are prioritizing novelty over utility. And that is where Dubé brings in this powerful professional analogy. He compares the bookmark investor to a high-powered trial lawyer or a surgeon.
I love this comparison. Let's break this down because it frames the value of time in a way that, well, in a way that hurts.
It's supposed to hurt.
Yeah.
So imagine a top-tier litigator, a real shark. Their time is billed at, let's say, $1,000 an hour. Easy number.
Okay.
They have a massive case on their desk, a $10 million corporate lawsuit. This case requires deep strategy, complex legal filings, late nights, a whole team. It justifies the $1,000 an hour rate.
Right.
The return on effort is massive.
Right. The payout matches the effort. It's a good use of that expensive time.
Now imagine a potential client walks in the door with a parking ticket dispute. It's a $100 fine.
Okay.
But the client is really annoying. The case is messy. It's going to take 10 hours of paperwork and court appearances to fight it. What does that lawyer do?
A rational lawyer kicks them out of the office or, you know, refers them to a junior associate or a different firm.
Yeah.
Instantly.
Instantly. And why? Not because the lawyer can't do the work. Of course they can. They are perfectly capable of fighting a parking ticket.
They're a great lawyer. They'd probably win.
They'd win. But the economics are completely broken. If they take the parking ticket case, they are effectively paying to work. They're diluting their own hourly rate from $1,000 down to $10. But more importantly, and this is the absolute key for us, they are taking 10 hours of their best mental energy away from the $10 million case.
They are prioritizing noise over signal. They're letting the trivial displace the important.
But investors do this every single day. We fill our portfolios with parking ticket cases. We have 40, 50, 60 positions. Most of them are tiny. And we tell ourselves we're being diversified.
Great. Prudent.
But really, we are just creating a crowded docket. Our minds are cluttered with low-value litigation.
So the bookmark isn't just a harmless placeholder. You're saying it's a parasite.
It is a liability on your cognitive bandwidth. And Dubé is very, very specific here. He says, quote, every position is a request for a decision.
A request for a decision.
Yes. And you have a finite number of high-quality decisions you can make in a year. Maybe only a handful of really good ones. Why on earth would you waste one on a parking ticket?
This reminds me so much of the concept of decision fatigue in psychology. The idea that if you spend all morning deciding what outfit to wear and what to have for breakfast, you have less willpower for the big important meeting in the afternoon.
It's exactly that. Obama famously said he only wore gray or blue suits for that very reason. He didn't want to waste a decision.
Right. He was saving his bandwidth.
But Dubé goes a step further. He doesn't just leave it as a psychological concept. He actually puts a price tag on it. And this is where I think everyone listening needs to lean in, because the math is, well, it's startling. This isn't just philosophy. It's cold, hard arithmetic.
Let's walk through the arithmetic of attention, because I think when people hear cognitive load, they think it's abstract, it's fuzzy. But the source material uses a very specific hypothetical scenario to prove that these small positions are, you know, mathematically insolvent.
Right. So let's construct the avatar. We have an investor, let's call her the infinite investor, and she's managing a $1 million portfolio. It's a nice round number, easy to work with.
Okay, $1 million.
This investor decides to take a flyer on a speculative biotech stock. Let's call it BioX. It's one of these binary outcome hit or miss type companies. And she buys a 0.2% position.
Okay, so on $1 million, 0.2% is, that's $2,000 invested.
$2,000, a tiny amount. Now, BioX is, by its nature, very volatile. It releases some phase one trial data. The stock just rips. It goes from $8 to $22 in a single day.
Wow, okay.
Then a short report comes out a week later, and it crashes back down to $13.
That's a pretty standard behavior for that sector. It's a total roller coaster. And honestly, for some people, that's part of the fun, right? The thrill.
Fun or not, let's watch the investor's behavior. She gets the notification on her phone. Her heart rate spikes. She immediately opens the brokerage app. She reads the press release, which is full of jargon she barely understands.
Then she goes to Reddit, or X, formerly Twitter, to see what all the anonymous accounts are saying about it.
Exactly. The scuttlebutt. She texts a friend. Did you see BioX? It's going crazy. She spends time debating with herself. Do I sell the pop? Do I take the profit? Do I buy the dip? Is the short report real or is it fake?
I have done this exact sequence of events so many times, it feels like investing. It feels like I'm being active and engaged.
But let's put a stopwatch on it. Let's log the hours.
Yeah.
Between the research, the checking, the worrying, the discussions. Let's say this one specific event, this one up and down move, consumes just 30 minutes of her focused attention.
And that seems incredibly conservative. I mean, I could lose an entire afternoon to that kind of rabbit hole. I've seen people on message boards lose weeks, months of their lives on stocks like this.
I agree. It's wildly conservative. But let's stick to 30 minutes just to be generous to the skeptic. Now, we have to price that time.
Okay.
If you are managing a $1 million portfolio, you are, in effect, a professional capital allocator. Your time has value. So let's assign a very reasonable consulting rate to your brain of, say, $300 per hour.
All right. That seems fair for a high-skilled professional. So 30 minutes of work costs $150.
You have just spent $150 of cognitive capital to service a position that is only worth $2,000.
So I just spent, 7.5% of the position's total value. Burned away in 30 minutes of thinking about it.
And that's just one event. A stock like BioX demands attention all year long. There are quarterly earnings calls, FDA filings, competitor news, macro moves that affect funding. A very conservative estimate is that you might spend, let's say, 4 to 6 hours a year just thinking about this one ticker.
So 6 hours at $300 an hour, that's $1,800.
$1,800 a year. That is your attention rent. Now look at the position size again. It's $2,000. You are essentially rebuying the entire position almost from scratch every single year with your brain power.
That is a stunning way to frame it. It's like a property with a 90% annual maintenance fee.
Exactly. No sane person would buy that property.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate here again, because I know what the listener is thinking right now. They're thinking, but I'm not writing a check for $1,800. I don't see that money leaving my bank account.
The invisible cost.
Right. And I'm not actually a consultant billing $300 an hour. If I wasn't looking at stocks, I'd just be on the couch watching Netflix. So the real cost is zero. What's the response to that?
That is the most common rebuttal. It's my hobby. It's entertainment. And you know what? If you are strictly an amateur and you are doing this purely for entertainment, if this is your version of fantasy football, then fine. Absolutely fine. Pay the $1,800 entrance fee and have fun. No judgment.
But that's not who this series is for.
Exactly. The source material is aimed at the infinite investor, someone who is trying to seriously compound wealth over a lifetime.
We are trying to win, not just play the game.
And if you are trying to win, you have to look at the expected value, or EV, of your actions. So let's be generous. Let's say you are a genius stock picker. You think BioX has a massive upside. You do a probability-weighted analysis, and you figure it has an expected return of 7% alpha on this stock above the market.
Okay, so on a $2,000 position, a 7% alpha is, what,
$140? $140. That's your expected profit for the year from this position. But you are spending $1,800 of your most valuable asset, your mental energy, to get it.
You're paying more than $12 for every $1 of expected profit.
It's like hiring a hedge fund manager who charges a 1,200% management fee. It is structurally, mathematically deficient. You're running a business where the overhead completely swamps the potential revenue.
But because the overhead is your own attention and it's not cash leaving the bank account, you don't see the loss. You don't feel it.
You don't feel it until years later when you look at your results and realize you missed the big, obvious move in your main portfolio, because you were too busy playing with the penny stocks in the corner.
This is a perfect segue into the deeper layer of costs. Because it's not just about the hourly rate, is it? It's about what Dubé calls displacement value. This is the opportunity cost argument, but weaponized.
Displacement is the absolute killer. The lawyer, in our analogy, doesn't just lose money on the parking ticket case because of the low hourly rate. The real loss is that they displace the $10 million case. They're too tired, too distracted to see the winning argument for the big client. That's the tragedy.
So if I wasn't wasting those 30 minutes on BioX, what could I have done instead? What is the alternative use of that precious, finite brain power?
Let's look at your main portfolio buckets. Let's say you have an index bucket and a compounder bucket, like we discussed in part one. Imagine you use that 30 minutes to do a proper deep dive on your overall asset allocation strategy. You look at interest rates, you look at valuations, you read some research, and you make a high-level decision. You know what? Given the current risk environment, I should move my index allocation from 10% to 15%.
On a $1 million portfolio, that's a $50,000 decision. You're shifting 50 grand from one bucket to another.
Right. That single decision controls $50,000 of capital. If the market just returns its historical average, that one decision made in 30 minutes of quiet, focused thought is worth somewhere between $5,000 to $7,000 a year in expected value.
Okay, let's just put those side by side. The BioX decision, focusing on that, has an expected value of maybe 20 bucks.
Let's call it $140 for the whole year, to be generous.
Okay, $140. The asset allocation decision is worth $5,000.
The ratio isn't even close. It's like 50 to 1 or 100 to 1.
But the BioX decision feels more urgent. That's the damn problem. The small stock is screaming, look at me, I'm moving. While the asset allocation decision is quiet and boring and requires real thought.
That is the tragedy of the modern investor. The urgent displaces the important. The noisy displaces the valuables. We spend our lives running around putting out tiny fires in the shed while the main house is burning down unnoticed.
Or what about the compounder bucket? Let's take another example. If I own a great company, say a high-quality tech monopoly, and I have 5% of my money in it.
Your best idea.
My best idea. If I spend that 30 minutes not on BioX, but on rereading their annual report or listening to an old conference call, and because of that, I gained the conviction to increase my position from 5% to 8%.
Now you're deploying another $30,000 into your highest conviction idea, a decision that could compound for decades. The return on attention there it's almost incalculable. It's astronomical.
So the cost of the bookmark isn't just the time wasted. It's the genius level decision you didn't make because your brain was fragmented and distracted.
Fragmented is the perfect word. The source of material talks a lot about switching costs. Every time you switch your focus from stock A to stock B, there's a cognitive penalty. It takes time for your brain to load the context, the story, the numbers.
It's like closing a big program on your computer and opening another one. There's a lag.
A huge lag. If you have 40 stocks in your portfolio, your brain is constantly buffering. You never reach flow state. You never get to that place of deep, uninterrupted insight where the best decisions are made.
You're just skimming the surface of 40 different things instead of truly understanding 5 or 10 things.
And in this game, skimming gets you killed. Depth is the only sustainable edge. If you're shallow, you're the patsy at the poker table.
There's a term in the text that I had to look up, but I think it applies here perfectly. Non-ergodicity.
Yes. The concept of ruin. This is a favorite of risk analysts like Nassim Taleb, and Bube applies it here beautifully.
Usually when we talk about this, we're talking about money. If you lose 100% of your capital, you can't keep playing. The game is over. That's a non-ergodic outcome. You can't come back from zero. But Dubé applies this to time and attention. How does that work?
Well, money is actually somewhat ergodic, which is a weird way to think about it, but it's true. If you make a terrible trade and you lose 20% of your net worth, it's painful. But you can recover.
You can work hard, save more money, wait for the market to come back.
Exactly. You can eventually get back to where you started. You can recover capital. It's hard, but it's possible.
True. I can earn my way back.
You cannot earn more time. You cannot recover attention. The 30 minutes you spent stressing out about BioX back in 2024, that is gone. It is deleted from the fabric of the universe. You can never, ever earn it back.
That's existential. It's a bit heavy for an investing discussion.
It is. Because it should be. The text says, time spent on a bookmark is time stolen from your best ideas or, more importantly, from your life. When you start to view your attention as a non-recoverable resource, literally a slice of your finite lifespan, you stop treating it so cheaply. You stop giving it away to penny stocks for free.
It really raises the stakes. We aren't just optimizing a spreadsheet here. We're optimizing our remaining time on Earth.
Exactly. If you have, say, 20 good years left of high-level cognitive function, do you really want to spend 3 of those years just reading press releases for companies you don't even really believe in?
No.
Do you want your tombstone to read, he tracked the price of a failing Canadian mining stock very, very closely?
Ouch. Okay. Point taken. I'm sufficiently terrified. I'm looking at my mental portfolio right now, and I see a lot of leaks. I see a lot of wasted life. So how do we fix this? Dubé doesn't just leave us in this pit of despair, does he? He offers a framework.
He does. He offers the Trinity.
A Trinity. It's a ruthless filtering mechanism for every single position in the portfolio.
And the key is that it only has 3 options. There is no hold and see. There is no gray area. There is no, I'll put it on the watch list.
That's the part I love. It forces a decision.
Correct. If a position is below what he calls your attention threshold, meaning it costs more to watch than it could ever possibly pay you. You have three choices and only three.
Let's go through them. Option one, eliminate.
The kill switch.
Yeah.
Sell it. Get it out of your life.
This is psychologically the hardest one for most people, isn't it? Because of FOMO. Fear of missing out. The minute I sell BioX, it's going to get bought out for a 300% premium. I know it. That's the nightmare scenario.
That is the fantasy you have to let go of. What if it pops? But you have to weigh that tiny hypothetical what if against the guaranteed real drag it is putting on your mind right now today. You are paying a guaranteed cost for a hypothetical benefit. The trade is a bad one.
So how do you get over that mental hurdle? How do you actually bring yourself to press the sell button on something you once had hope for?
You have to reframe it. You have to admit that the mental clarity of not owning it is an asset in itself. It has a positive value. When you sell a noisy, annoying position, you feel a physical weight lift off your shoulders. The source material calls this cognitive alpha.
Cognitive alpha, the value of a clear head.
And successful people are masters of this. The text quotes Warren Buffett, who said, "The difference between successful people and really successful people is that really successful people say no to almost everything."
They're constantly eliminating. They're pruning the garden.
Exactly. You have to say no to the noise so you can say a powerful yes to the real signal. If you can't say no, you aren't an investor. You're a collector.
A hoarder.
Okay, but let's say I genuinely like the sector. I still want exposure to the promise of biotech. I don't have the time or the PhD to analyze the specific drugs of 10 different companies. That brings us to option two.
Option two, consolidate.
This is the basket approach.
Right.
You take those six tiny biotech lottery tickets you have in your portfolio, sell all of them, take the cash from those sales, and just buy XBI, the biotech ETF, or whichever index best covers that theme.
What does that really solve, though? I still own the sector. I still have the volatility.
You own the exposure, but you have outsourced the monitoring. That's the critical difference.
Ah. So I don't have to read the individual earnings reports for the ETF.
Exactly. You don't have to wake up in a panic because one of the companies in the index had a trial failure. You don't care if one specific company fails because the index automatically rebalances away from it. You don't have to check FDA approvals. You have kept the potential financial upside of the sector, but you have eliminated the specific cognitive liability of the single stock.
That's a massive leverage move. You get to keep the potential return, but you cut the attention cost down to near zero.
It's efficient, it's professional, and it requires humility. It's an admission that says, I don't have a specific edge in picking the winner in this complex field, but I do believe in the theme and I want to be in the game. Humility saves you a lot of time.
Okay. So we can eliminate or consolidate, but what if I do have an edge? What if I look at that small position and I say, no, this isn't noise. I've done the work. I understand this company better than the market does. This company is going to be the next Amazon. I know it in my bones.
Then you have option three. And this is the one that calls your bluff. This is the one that separates the tourists from the professionals. Option three is promote.
Promote means buy more. A lot more.
It means size it up until it matters. Size it up until it hurts a little.
The quote from the text is just brutal here. It says, if you aren't willing to make it a 3% or 5% position, you don't actually have conviction. You are just spectating.
That is the ultimate litmus test. So many investors hide in these tiny positions. They say, I have high conviction in this stock, but they hold a 0.5% weight. Why? It's a contradiction. It's because they're engaging in what's called emotional hedging.
Explain that. What is emotional hedging?
If the stock goes up, they can tell all their friends at the cocktail party, I own that. I knew it. I'm a genius. But if it goes down to zero, they don't lose enough money to actually feel pain. They want the ego boost of being right without the real-world financial risk of being wrong.
They want the credit without the debit.
They want to be right without the possibility of being wrong. So promote forces you to put your money where your mouth is. It forces you to be intellectually honest.
If it's a good idea, it deserves to be a real position. It deserves to be in the compounder bucket. And if you can't justify making it 5% of your net worth, then by definition, you don't understand it well enough or believe in it enough to own it at all.
And if that's the case,
then you should sell it. You go right back to option one, eliminate.
Eliminate, consolidate, or promote. There is no middle ground. There is no fourth option.
No bookmarks. Bookmarks are for books, not for your capital.
Exactly.
So if we follow this rigorous logic, if we actually scrub the portfolio this way, we're going to end up with a very specific kind of portfolio structure. We end up with a concentrated portfolio. And concentration is a very controversial word in finance.
It is. The first thing they teach you in Finance 101 is modern portfolio theory. You're told to diversify. It's the only free lunch.
Right. Buy a little bit of everything so you don't blow up if one thing goes wrong. But Dubé completely flips this. He argues that concentration is actually a tool for safety. How can that be?
It's safety through competence. This is a crucial distinction. Usually people associate concentration with aggression, with risk-taking. Put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket like a hawk.
But Dubé's argument is that concentration preserves attention. That's the real benefit.
Think about it. If you only own 10 positions, you can realistically read every annual report. You can listen to every earnings call. You can probably even know the management team's histories. You can track the competitors. You are an expert on every single thing in your portfolio. You know what you own inside and out.
You have a genuine informational edge, or at least you're not at a disadvantage.
But if you own 50 positions or 100, you are structurally incapable of that depth. It's not possible. You're just relying on luck and market beta at that point. By concentrating, you are aligning your portfolio's complexity with your brain's actual cognitive capacity.
So holding 50 stocks actually makes you dumber relative to each individual stock.
Dilutes the intellect to the point of incompetence. That's the direct quote. You're spreading a finite amount of jam over way too much bread. You end up with a portfolio that you barely understand, which is fine in a bull market, but leads to absolute panic selling when the market drops. You don't have the conviction to hold on.
I want to talk about one specific asset in this new, clean, concentrated portfolio. The most boring one. One everyone hates in a bull market. Cash.
The unloved asset, yes.
We're always told cash is a drag. Cash is trash. Inflation is eating it alive. It's earning maybe 4% or 5%, but the market is doing 15%. Why on earth would I hold cash? It feels like losing every single day.
In the infinite investor framework, cash has a superpower that no other asset on the planet possesses. What is the attention cost of cash?
It's zero. Absolutely zero.
Zero. It requires no monitoring. It has no earnings misses. The CEO of the U.S. dollar isn't going to tweet something offensive and tank the value by 20% overnight. It doesn't require you to wake up at 4 a.m. to check the futures in Asia.
It just sits there. It does nothing.
It sits there. It is a battery. It stores financial value, yes, but more importantly, it stores your attention.
So when I'm holding cash, I'm not just preserving capital. I'm preserving my sanity. I'm preserving my bandwidth.
Precisely. So when you rerun the comparison between that 0.3% speculative biotech stock and cash, the math completely changes. The biotech stock might earn more money, and that's a big maybe, but it consumes a very high amount of attention. Cash earns less money, but it consumes zero attention.
So if you view attention as a real cost, as a real expense, then cash becomes incredibly cheap to hold.
And it provides what the pros call optionality. Because your mind isn't distracted by all the noise, your head is clear, your desk is clean. So when the market actually does crash, when the true fat pitch comes along, the opportunity of a decade, you are ready.
You have the dry powder, the money, and you have the mind space to act decisively.
Most people, when the market crashes 30%, are paralyzed. Why? Because their 50 tiny positions are all screaming at them at once. They're down 40, 50, 60%. They are completely overwhelmed. The concentrated investor who is holding a slug of cash is calm. They're a predator. They strike when others are panicking.
It reframes cash from a drag on returns to a strategic cognitive battery. I really like that. It's the difference between being busy and being ready.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, so we've stripped the portfolio down. We've killed the bookmarks. We've consolidated the noise. We are holding cash as a strategic asset. What is the ultimate payoff for all this hard work? Dubé calls this the cognitive 100 bagger.
This is the concept that ties it all together. And it's a big idea. We all know what a financial 100 bagger is. You put $10,000 in Apple in 2002, and you have a fortune today.
It's the holy grail of investing. It's what everyone is chasing.
But Dubé asks a different question. What is a cognitive 100 bagger? And the idea is that your decisions compound over time, just like money does.
Walk me through this mechanism. How does a single decision compound?
Let's go back to our displacement example. You made the hard choice to eliminate the biotech bookmark. You saved yourself, let's say, 30 minutes of angst that week. You use that newly freed up 30 minutes to deepen your conviction on your number one compounder, and you sized it up from 5% to 8%.
Okay, a simple one-time action.
That decision made on a Tuesday in 2026 sets a new trajectory for your wealth. That extra 3% you allocated to a great company grows at, say, 20% a year for the next 15 years. The $140 of attention savings today isn't just $140. It is the seed of a position that could be worth millions in the year 2040.
So the clarity you gain today literally echoes through the next decade of your returns. It's not a one-time benefit.
And it's recursive. It's a feedback loop. It feeds back on itself. If you clear the noise from your mind today, you make better decisions this year. Better decisions mean your portfolio performs better. A better performing portfolio gives you more capital to work with next year. And because you have trained your brain to focus, you are even better at allocating that larger amount of capital.
It's a flywheel, a competence flywheel.
Yes. You are literally upgrading the operating system of your mind. And Dubé makes a fascinating connection here to the work of Hendrik Bessembinder,
the famous academic study on long-term stock returns.
Right. Bessembinder proved, pretty conclusively, that only about 4% of stocks account for all the net wealth creation in the stock market above and beyond what you'd get from treasury bills. Most stocks are, financially speaking, duds.
96% of stocks are just noise, or worse, they lose money.
So Dubé takes that, and he applies Bessembinder's law to your brain. He suggests that just as 4% of stocks generate all the wealth, probably only 4% of your decisions generate all of your investment success.
That feels intuitively true. If I look back at my own investment history, my entire net worth really comes down to 3 or 4 key moments. Buying the right thing at the right time, or maybe more importantly, not selling the right thing during a panic.
Everything else was just busy work. Everything else was noise, tinkering at the edges. The entire goal of this attention cost framework is to clear away all the debris so that you don't miss those 4% moments when they arrive.
Because if you're distracted by the 96% of junk, you might be too tired or too confused or too scared to see the diamond when it walks right into the room.
Or you might just be out of capital because you sprinkled it all on 100 different bookmarks.
There's a great quote in the notes. The best investors don't have more brain power, they waste less of it.
That's the quote to put on the wall. We look at people like Munger or Buffett, and we think they're supercomputers. And of course, they're incredibly smart. But their real genius is in what they don't do. They don't day trade. They don't chase hot trends. They don't hold 500 stocks. They sit in a room, they read, and they wait.
They respect the attention cost above all else.
They treat their attention as the scarcest asset on the planet. Because it is.
This has been, well, cleansing is the word that comes to mind. It really forces you to look in the mirror. We've gone from the bookmark pathology to the brutal arithmetic of what those bookmarks cost, to the trinity of solutions, and finally to this idea of the cognitive 100 bagger.
It's a journey from mental clutter to mental clarity.
If we had to boil this entire deep dive down, if the listener is going to take just one thing away with them, what is it?
It's that your portfolio isn't just a collection of financial assets on a screen. It is a psychological environment, and you have to live inside that environment every single day.
And you have to ask yourself, is it a nice place to live, or is it a chaotic, stressful mess?
Exactly. If your portfolio is cluttered, noisy, and stressful, your life will become cluttered, noisy, and stressful, and you will likely get poor returns to boot. You have to clean your room.
I have a challenge for our listeners, and this is implied very heavily in the source material. Right now, or as soon as you aren't driving your car open, your brokerage app.
Do it. Don't be afraid.
Don't look at the total value. Don't look at your winners. Scroll all the way to the bottom of the list. Find the runt. Find the position that is lowest in dollar value, but highest in what I'd call the cringe factor.
You know the one? The one where you see the ticker symbol and you just feel a little pang of guilt or annoyance or regret?
That is your leak. That is your cognitive parasite. And the challenge is this. Apply the trinity to it this week. Eliminate it, consolidate it, or promote it. Do not let it sit there stealing your attention for another year.
Reclaim that bandwidth. And just imagine what you could do with it.
And that is the perfect transition. Because we are building towards something very important in this series.
We are. It's a sequence.
We covered capital in part one. That was the fuel for the journey. We've just covered attention in part two. That's the engine. But there's a destination. Why are we doing all this? Why are we trying to get rich and be so efficient with our minds?
To get the ultimate resource back. Yeah. The only thing that actually matters in the end. Time. Your life.
And that is the subject of part three, The Mountain Guide. It's about building a portfolio that doesn't just make you rich on paper, but actually sets you free in the real world. It's the philosophical peak of the entire series.
I can't wait for that one. That's where the rubber really meets the road for life design.
It's going to be a good one. But for now, go clean up those bookmarks.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you next time.